This is the takeaway for Friday, May 6, 2016.
This is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Call it the 2016 gender flap.
I respect women. I love women. I cherish women. I respect women incredibly. I have had women working for me in positions that they've never worked in terms of so many different jobs. I have given women more opportunity than I would say virtually anybody in the construction industry.
Well, of course you have, Mr. Trump. Donald Trump's boorish attitudes toward women and comments about women, including his likely opponent Hillary Clinton, have made him a national lightning rod for the discussion of women in politics. In October of 1991, it was a panel of middle-aged white men on the Senate Judiciary Committee during the Clarence Thomas hearings confronting a black woman law school professor, Anita Hill, that became a lightning rod for the discussion of women's rights in America. Here's Republican Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania.
You said that you took it to mean that Judge Thomas wanted to have sex with you, but in fact, he never did ask you to have sex, correct?
No, he did not ask me to have sex. He did continually pressure me to go out with him, continually. And he would not accept my explanation as one as being valid.
The dramatic Thomas hearings became an opportunity for Democrats in 1992. In part, it gave momentum to Bill Clinton, but it was a real boon for women candidates for Congress, women, some of whom are household names in politics today.
The Democratic senatorial nominees, Carol Moseley Braun, Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein, Lynn Yackel.
The 1992 Democratic National Convention ended with a 45-minute celebration of the female congressional candidates. The number of women in the Senate went from 2 to 6 that year. Lynn Yackel, I heard your name being called there. Do you remember that moment at the Democratic Convention in New York?
Hi, John. I certainly remember it clearly. It was quite an experience.
And would you say that the momentum and the sense that women had an opportunity in 1992 stemmed from the Anita Hill hearings and was vindicated in 92, or was it repudiated in 92?
I guess I would say both in a way. I think it certainly generated a lot of civic engagement on the part of women, and it certainly was the reason that I decided to run. I had grown up in Washington, so I was no stranger to the Congress because my father was in the Congress, but I had never run for office. And because of the anger that women felt, particularly focused on the senator from our state, who had been the prime questioner, as you just played, I was encouraged to get out there and represent women's voices and views. And frankly, as you said, the realization that there were just men on the Judiciary Committee and that there were only two women in the Senate, I think was something that came as a great shock to women, and that was a big factor in that year.
Today, Lynn Yackel is director of Drexel University's College of Medicine's Institute for Women and Leadership. Now, you lost that Pennsylvania Senate race in 1992, and you were going up against Arlen Specter, as you said there. Was it something about your candidacy? Specter, of course, was a powerful incumbent. I mean, I really felt for you going up against Specter in 92. What do you attribute your loss to, and what do you think the overall national lessons of 92 were?
Well, first of all, I like to say that I almost won because I did win the Democratic primary, as you know, and I was only the second woman in Pennsylvania history to win the Democratic primary, and we've just had another one win just a few weeks ago in Pennsylvania, and maybe she will be the first woman elected to the U.S. Senate from this state.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there were so many factors. One was that I think the public hadn't quite come to grips with women as political candidates. That certainly changed this year, and that's a very good thing because I'd like to see every election year be a year of the woman. There was a lot of difference of opinion as to how women candidates should behave. We definitely were held to a higher standard. And in fact, there was a Pew Research study just last year about public attitudes having changed in terms of women being as qualified as men to be in top leadership positions. But barriers still remain, including the expectation that women have achieved higher levels of performance. So we need to fix that.
Now, there are candidates in 9 states. There are some very high-profile races. Ann Kirkpatrick is running against John McCain, the incumbent in Arizona. That reminds me of your race against Arlen Specter. What do you make of the candidates this year, and how hopeful are you?
Oh, I'm very hopeful, and I'm so glad to see so many women running. And frankly, that was the phenomenon in 1992. It was the first time that women had really run in serious numbers for high positions. And I think now the public is much more accustomed to seeing women as candidates, certainly from the top on down. And I think these candidates are all wonderful. So I hope we're going to see many more women in the Senate. I mean, it's interesting that the pace of progress for women has been glacially slow in government. And even though we've gone from 2 women in the U.S. Senate to 20 now, that's still just 1 in 5. It's just 20%. And so one of the things I'm working on at Drexel is this national initiative called Vision 2020, which is focused on the year 2020 and the centennial of women's voting rights, and encouraging women to really get engaged in public life from everything from the school board on up, and to vote. And we actually have a 100% eligible women voting goal for the year 2020. So that's a little ambitious, but you know, it's a great goal.
Lynn Yackel is director of Drexel University's College of Medicine's Institute for Women's Health and Leadership and a former Senate and gubernatorial candidate from Pennsylvania. Great to talk to you, Lynn.
Thanks, John.
Kim Alfano is a Republican strategist and CEO of Alfano Communications. Kim, how do you remember the 1992 wave of women seeking to enter Congress?
I recall 92 and 94 as being waves both because I think the country was ready for some change. And I think we're there now again. But back then, it was bringing the soccer moms, remember that phrase?
Sure.
The soccer moms to the forefront. It was a bunch of very feisty, exciting women. It wasn't, you know, your traditional, what we grew up with, the Bella Abzugs and the kind of more traditionally conservative, not conservative, but traditionally masculine. I hate to say that.
Well, traditionally feminist, the feminist activists. It was.
I think that 92 brought this more approachable, relatable type female to Congress and to the Senate. And that was it was the start of some good things.
How important was the Anita Hill hearings and the Clarence Thomas hearings to galvanizing a sense that women needed to be represented in Congress if government was going to function?
I think that it maybe shone a light on the lack of females in Congress and in the Senate. But I think there was a lot going on at the time. I think you saw a lot of emerging female CEOs. You saw a lot more women in the workplace and the need sort of becoming greater for 2-income families. And so women had emerged from that, like we said, old-fashioned feminist definition to becoming the doers, the movers, and the shakers. And it was, I think it was a natural transition. And I think Anita Hill may have kicked it into gear.
How would you say the potential for Donald Trump kicking things into gear again with his 70% unfavorables among women voters, how likely is Trump as a lightning rod to either attract women voters, attract women candidates, or affect this sort of gender orientation within the 2016 campaign in an unusual and unpredictable way?
Well, I would say, again, we're at the precipice of another natural transition for females. I've been in this business for 30 years. I don't see the differences I used to see. I see that it's not an unnatural thing to see a female CEO of a corporate 100 company. It's not an unnatural thing to that Hillary Clinton is running for president. It's not this jaw-dropping, oh my God, she's amazing type deal. It's sort of predictable. We knew she was going to do it. So, and I think at this point in the country, the gender disparity in terms of what is possible in many people's mind is not as great as it used to be. So I think we're on the precipice of it anyway. Donald Trump certainly does ignite passion around the issue of women. And if you're for him or against him, you certainly have an opinion about that. But I would caution people running, as I would have in 92, if you're running just because you're a woman, that doesn't work anymore. I think that if you run a race that tries to capitalize on this, you know, imaginary war against women or something along those lines, you are missing the anger and the angst that's out there and what it really means for people.
So what do you make of this campaign video that has all these women saying quotes of Donald Trump that are offensive? And the idea is you really have to vote with Hillary Clinton.
Listen, he's a misogynistic jerk. Nobody doubts that. But the country, I think, is, while they're worried about that, no one wants their child to look up to that. No one wants that representing us. At the same time, there are greater issues of what we call up ballot pressures. You know, there are greater issues of more immediate importance to people, which is why Donald Trump is succeeding. It's a genuine fear of our personal safety from threats from outside this country. It's a genuine fear of the economy just crashing to the point where we return to a Great Depression and people not having jobs. It's a genuine fear of these more kitchen table and visceral and immediate problems. And I think that, again, I would say that, yes, we can all hate him, but people want him in the presidency despite hating him. I'd be the first person on a playground to probably walk over and slap that kid if I met him. But at this moment in our history, nothing is working, and we are desperate for a different type of leadership.
So, Kim, you're a Republican strategist. Would you allow me to come along when you go into the voting booth in November? It sounds like you're going to have a pretty interesting decision to make.
Sure. I mean, I'm a good Republican, and I want to do what's best for this country first, because that's what good Republicans care about, and my party next. And I honestly don't believe that Hillary Clinton will present any type of change, any type of disruption, any type of innovative new way of approaching things. So I already know that that won't be good for this country.
Kim Alfano, Republican strategist and CEO of Alfano Communications. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you.
This was once a high-tech demo.
For phones, fax machines, and voice and data systems to help you succeed.
This is going to be good.
Regular people are going to be able to do all sorts of stuff over their telephone.
Call Southwestern Bell.
With Southwestern Bell, you got great connection.
It's who you know.
Rotary phones, touch tone phones, all symbols and reminders of a communication technology all but gone today. Here are the guardians of your old dial tone, besieged and on strike. The voices of some of the nearly 36,000 Verizon workers who went on strike 3 weeks ago. The workers have been without a contract since August, while the company has been eagerly shedding more than 60% of its landline workforce in the last 10 years. Those fewer workers cover much larger territories and working shifts far from home. Pete Coble is a 61-year-old driver for Verizon from Queens.
Bounced around from job to job in Verizon because they keep on shutting down stuff they're not supposed to be shutting down. And we're kind of tired of it.
Two unions, the CWA and the IBEW, represent almost 40,000 workers on the East Coast. But those unions have barely cracked the workforce in the largely non-union wireless sector, which is why the strike has been so low profile. Susan Crawford is a professor at Harvard Law School and author of Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. She says these striking workers are fighting for their jobs, but also for an image of the old Bell system that history, technology, and the company have left behind.
Verizon is not a phone company. It tells Wall Street it's a diversified media company. So you may be thinking of it as guys with lines putting wires down. In fact, 70% of their $32 billion a year comes from wireless, and wireless is not unionized. Verizon has every incentive to drive down its costs and get rid of the $168 billion in unfunded pension and health care benefits it has on its books by getting rid of the union.
There's no pathway necessarily for these workers for the future. And I'm just wondering, whither these workers?
Well, Verizon says they're already seeing people crossing the picket lines and that they're able to hire temporary workers to take the place. This is like the bigger story of the Uberization of the economy, I'd say. Verizon doesn't need these workers as much as the workers need Verizon.
And is it the case that these workers only do work on these old lines? Or what about fiber? What about Fios? What about all these other cables that have been laid?
Well, absolutely. Verizon's Fios workers are unionized. But Verizon's backing away from Fios as fast as it can. It just sold off its systems in California, in Texas, and in Florida. It had already gotten rid of all of its wires in New Hampshire and Vermont and Maine. So they're really drawing down to just those few leafy, dense areas of the Northeast where they think they have business customers that will buy their services and where people are rich enough, they think, to pay for Fios. Fios is very expensive. We pay more per month than a service in Seoul or Tokyo that has 10 times as much capacity.
Wow. So as a consumer story, what's the significance of this strike?
The significance is that we're seeing these companies treat telecommunications as a luxury, as a delivery platform for vertically integrated businesses, and as a largely unregulated, very expensive, rare service. The really big story is that the entire nation should be upgrading its wires to fiber, and they should be cheap and ubiquitous and available to everyone. We're missing out on a future we otherwise should be having.
Is there any consumer impulse to help the workers? In other words, there's this town in Massachusetts, Braintree, which has said, we are going to support the workers. Is that a useful impulse? Is that going to help these workers, or does it underscore the fact that this whole era of copper is going away?
Well, this is a demographic issue that Braintree Town is also older. They have a lot of copper, and the people who live there are older. Young people are relying on wireless and do see this as a luxury, don't really understand the idea of a basic wired network, and don't understand that those wireless devices they love, on which they depend, actually need wires in order to perform. So we're sort of in an ahistorical, uncontextual moment of profit-making, and not a lot of Americans seem to understand.
Would you say the way that the Verizon is treating these workers is in violation of some compact that has existed really long before Verizon, 9X, Bell Atlantic, the old Bell system?
The American social contract was always to provide everybody with a wire that was the best in its class, and those were unionized jobs for a long time. Neither of those compacts now exist. We haven't made a commitment as a country to have a great wired network. We don't seem to have any path to do it.
And so these workers who were once the high-tech workers in America are being cast by Verizon as something that should be sort of tossed out.
I think their motive here is really financial, and it's not so much creating them as one kind of character or another. What they're doing is plowing their profits into dividends and share price rather than worrying about the workers. And there are a lot of American industries that act the same way.
And the power of this strike is not going to be sufficient to compel Verizon to do anything, in your view?
I don't think so. I mean, Verizon's buzz rating is down as a consumer matter, but they still have enormous pricing power on the wireless side where they really live.
Susan Crawford, professor at Harvard Law School, author of Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Verizon strike has been mostly invisible outside of the Northeast. That's because in most of the nation, the idea of the traditional telephone service is radically changing. It's estimated that 85% of California consumers have ditched their traditional landlines. Wireless, fiber, and digital media produce most of the $4.22 billion in profit made by Verizon last year. But the city of Braintree, Massachusetts, has lots of old-style copper landlines. The city has voted to support the Verizon workers and says it will not purchase any Verizon products for the duration of the strike. Joining me now from the land of the reliable dial tone, Braintree Mayor Joseph Sullivan. Welcome, Mayor.
John, how are you?
So, Mayor, the strike, the Verizon strike, has it had a big impact on your community?
I think it's had an impact. I don't know if I'd catalog it as big, but we do have quite a few employees. So I guess to the extent that it's impacted families here in town, you'd have to consider it big in some ways. I know a lot of folks who work for Verizon, as do members of the town council, and that's why we took this step as a community to demonstrate support for these workers and for the families of people who are impacted by this current strike.
What do you think the chances are that your endorsement of the workers would have any kind of an impact?
Well, I would hope it would have an impact. We've made a statement of support, and the reason we have is because we care about these families, and we know it's been impactful for them. And in some regard, obviously, there's a multiplier to that that makes it impactful for the community here as well. I think when there's a need to stand up, you have to demonstrate where you stand.
Are you calling for a boycott of Verizon, a discontinuance of Fios?
No, we are not. We do not want, as a community, to get engaged with any new type of activity that Verizon may be offering, any type of new contracts or obligations to purchase any type of Verizon products going forward while the strike continues. But we're not right now asking or directing anyone to rid themselves of any type of Verizon business arrangements that they have.
Do you think that consumers would be better served through a traditional old monopoly or a federally administered and subsidized communications infrastructure?
I'm probably not in a position to make that type of judgment. I guess, the ultimate statement they were making in terms of this resolution from the town of Braintree, Massachusetts, is to indicate to the Verizon executives, to the company, that they need to treat their workers, I think, in a much more fair and empathetic way. I've had a chance. It's not the first time that this type of strike has taken place. I've walked with the workers 4 years ago when we had a similar type of situation. Fortunately, that got resolved. It just seems to me that, every 4 years or so, you get to this point where there's a polarized position, and it doesn't help really anybody.
Finally, what about the company's tactics and strategy and behavior here has most outraged you?
It's my understanding that Verizon management, Verizon executives have been rather dismissive of some of the workers' concerns. And so that troubles me. I think we, as a community, have always tried to work in a way with our union employees that recognizes their value. And we've been fair and reasonable, and I think we would hope that Verizon management would recognize the value of the Verizon worker, the impact that it has on their family, and consequently make good decisions in terms of trying to come to an agreement here that would hopefully foster a positive relationship going forward.
Speaking on a trusty Verizon landline connection, Mayor Joseph Sullivan of Braintree, Massachusetts. Take you now to the woods of Wisconsin, a recording studio where Craig Minowa, the songwriter, vocalist, and many instrument playing leader of the band Cloud Cult, loves to escape.
I'll spend a lot of time just going back in the woods and sitting there with a recorder and a guitar.
Cloud Cult's new album, The Seeker, was released earlier this year. The band is just now releasing a companion film as well. It's a dreamy art piece about love and loss, just the kinds of things Minowa thinks about in his Escape to Nature studio space. Although Minowa would call his process of creativity more like a pilgrimage.
The ensembles that you come up with, everyone in Minnesota is in a choir at some point, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right. And you were, right? Correct?
Yeah, you had church choir growing up.
Uh-huh. Right. And probably some sort of marching band.
Mm, yeah, played in the orchestra.
So what was the instrument?
I started with violin and went to upright bass.
I see. And so all that gets mixed into this whole kind of composer scene.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And then as far as being raised in the church and having the music be such a central part of your spirituality and your attempt to get in touch with some kind of higher power, although my belief systems have changed over the years, the use of the tool of music as a tool for getting in touch with things outside of the self is still remains the same.
Call your name and you form out of the emptiness. Call your name and I swear this time will be my best. Called your name and I felt home sweet home.
You attempt to do that, it seems, in To the Great Unknown. Mm-hmm. You're aiming for a place outside of the self.
Every Cloud Cult album since the loss of our son back in 2002 has been an attempt to try and get to in touch with something bigger. And at that time, it was a blatant, intentional thing of where I had recordings of his voice going constantly and I was writing music to that. And I felt the physical world disappear and I felt that ethereal world become very apparent. And I felt such comfort in being in that place that the Cloud Cult sort of pathway became this thing of obsessively trying to get to that point of where that veil between the physical and the ethereal doesn't exist, and it's because you're in this trance through the ritual of music.
So if ever I can't see the magic around me, please take my hands off my eyes.
There's a family quality to Cloud Cult that is not cult. It's literally your collaboration with your wife.
Yeah, family and friends as family are huge elements to what we do as far as who we choose to bring into the band. The audition process is really extensive because it's not just how are you as a musician, but what do you use music for as a tool, you know, something that's fun to do, or is it something that brings you to a deep space too? And do you understand the power of music as far as this thing that our ancestors used for thousands of years to get in touch with the divine? And so you have to have like a group of people that understands the intention behind that, but then also a group of people with really high ethical standards, because that's just something that's important as far as how we run this business. We want everything to be honest and authentic and people to be in it for the right reason. To be able to do it with my wife all these years has been absolutely phenomenal.
We grew up believing we could learn how to fly. We came from the earth, but we belong to the sky.
After the loss of your child, was there a place that your wife didn't want you to go in terms of your composition, and she would say, I don't want to go there, you would go there, or something maybe even in reverse, where she was interested in exploring something and you were just not ready?
Not necessarily. She's a visual artist, and so she really worked through her grief through painting, and we both went into a lot of seclusion, and I would have never guessed that Cloud Cult was going to take off into something that was going to be a career. I had a career as an environmental scientist for a nonprofit organization, so using it as a personal tool for grieving, I don't think either of us had any sort of restriction on the other person.
Please excuse the light shooting out of my head. I keep them in a cage, but they come out when they see a friend.
How do you expect people to experience the album and the movie?
We kind of intentionally released the album first, so that came out in February. And the film is doing the film festival circuit for a while. So that won't come out publicly for until late 2016, and the intention there is that we want people to listen to the album, kind of have a personal experience with it, and then see the film and not have to listen to the album and see the literal pictures of the film, because first and foremost, the album was written as a traditional Cloud Cult album, of something that we want everybody to be able to embrace. And it wasn't until a couple of years into the process that there was a realization of, well, there's a story here, and this is a story that we could actually logistically pull off.
And everyone here has got a shadow. And everyone's got their share of hurt. When I'm dead, I'll be a rainbow.
2016.
2016 campaign, new leadership in America, democracy, mm-hmm. our identity as a country. Following that at all?
Oh, of course, yeah. Obsessively.
What do you think?
Just like everybody else. You know, different band members have different opinions, so I have to respect, like, not giving a straight out endorsement. And generally speaking, I think there's a lot of fear out there that people are going to work their way around and get their heads straight and figure out who the best candidate is. I'm not as worried as a lot of people are. Just people's involvement in general indicates that we are a people with a lot of hope for making things better, whatever that may be. We're not apathetic, just floating here waiting to be taken care of. And I'm supercharged by that. We have to stay optimistic and keep all intention on the laser beam of focus of hope. And that's the only way we're going to have enough energy to be able to overcome some of the big obstacles in front of us.
Greg Minowa is the lead singer and songwriter of Cloud Cult. The Seeker is out now. Started this hour thinking about tough women in American politics. And speaking of tough women who never say die, who hang in there and hang tough, our culture reporter Melissa Locker is someone who doggedly pursues a story in her work for the Vanity Fair, The Guardian, and Time. She suggests that we all take a break this weekend and check out the 7-year conclusion to the acclaimed CBS series about a tough, stalwart woman, The Good Wife.
This is the 7th season wrapping up on Sunday night, and it has really established itself as one of the best courtroom dramas ever.
It's the miserable marriage drama as well, right?
Absolutely. It's, you know, Alicia Florek standing by her man, Peter Florek, as they battle their way through the political scene of Chicago, working through Chicago corruption and the kind of insane stuff that goes on behind the scenes of political races.
I want to be clear. I have never abused my office. I have never traded lighter sentences for financial or sexual favors. At the same time, I need to atone for my personal failings with my wife, Alicia, and our 2 children. The money used in these transactions was mine, and mine alone. No public funds were ever utilized. But I do admit to a failure of judgment.
The twist here is that Peter Florek, though, is really a bad guy.
Well, yes and no. I find you kind of end up almost rooting for him, but at the same time, he does just make bad choice after bad choice after bad choice, and he definitely does do some very questionable things, but Alicia is just done with him. She really has no interest in him by the time that season 7 rolls around.
Here's an example of their interaction.
Alicia, I know this has been hard on you, but you have to believe me, I'm innocent of the abuse of office charges.
You think I give a damn about that, Peter? They're playing a tape in Grace's computer lab of you sucking the toes of a hooker. You think I care about the small print in your employment contract?
Oh, come on, I was set.
Oh, come on, Peter, I don't want to talk. I'm not going to fight.
Her hanging in there as a narrative, how does that hold up for 7 years?
Well, surprisingly, it actually holds up really well because they've been fake separated, but while their 2 careers have kind of led them on divergent paths, they both need each other in this way that only political families can probably really understand. So if you look at the Clintons or Anthony Weiner and his wife, they both need each other in this way that sort of civilians won't really get. But this show does a really great job of kind of digging into what those reasons are and humanizing them in a lot of ways.
The finale, she's not going to run off to Ibiza with some model from Brazil.
She might. I've heard the finale is very controversial. And people, they've been seeding it, and it's hard to say what's going to happen. But we do know that Alicia, over the course of the last 7 seasons, has really started to come into her own. She's standing on her own feet. And there's a lot of hints that she's just going to make her own move to be herself. And it'll just be up to fans to figure out whether they're actually happy with the ending or not. But I do think it's going to be one of those that people are going to be debating, you know, Monday morning around the, you know, water cooler.
If you can stand up around the water cooler, at least if you're this age, you could go to this rock festival, Old Cella, which is your second offering here, which right. I've actually seen and looked at, and I can't believe these guys would actually sign up to do this.
Its real name is Desert Trip, but the production company behind it, who also produced Coachella and Stagecoach, I can't even imagine the amount of money that they must have thrown at these people to make this festival happen, because it really is like the absolute dream fest for baby boomers. Paul McCartney, the Rolling Stones, Roger Waters, The Who, Bob Dylan, and Neil Young all playing on one festival.
Why would these guys do this?
I can only think it's money, or it's some sort of insane last hurrah where they really were like, let's just get all of our remaining fans together and just go out in style.
The audience will go where?
It's in Indio, California, down in Coachella Valley. It's the same place as Stagecoach and Coachella. You can camp on site, or you can pay to stay in one of the many, many hotels in the area. I would recommend staying in a hotel, but that's just me. Having done Coachella several times, I think it's a great opportunity to not sleep in the desert, but, you know, to each your own.
And when is it?
It's coming up in October. I believe tickets go on sale next week. The Desert Trip is just truly a lineup for people who have either lived through the era, or if, you know, people want to take their kids to see these bands who were making the charts back when they were kids.
Musical archaeology in the desert. Desert Trip and The Good Wife, two offerings from Melissa Locker. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Melissa Locker, culture reporter for The Takeaway, and she's written for The Guardian and Time, Vanity Fair. You see your byline all over the place.
You want answers?
You haven't answered my question.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
So, do you come to Milwaukee often?
You know how fast you were going?
How can we be expected to teach children to learn how to read if they can't even fit inside the building?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
You can't handle the truth!
Here with the truth about movies on Friday is Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Hey, Rafer.
Hey, John.
So, Captain America Civil War, $200 million weekend release. That's the expectation. I guess Marvel can go anywhere. Crimean War, we could do Revolutionary War.
That's right. You know, he is immortal. We could keep going on to many, many wars.
Russo, Japanese War. And Anthony Russo is the director of this.
Joe and Anthony Russo, that's right.
Exactly. Let's see our clip.
Guess I should have knocked.
Oh, my God. What are you doing here?
Disappointing my kids. I'm supposed to go water skiing. Cap needs our help. Come on.
Clint! You should not be here.
Not exactly a Ken Burns feel. There's how much Civil War is there in here, and how much Marvel is there?
Well, the Civil War is between the Avengers themselves. Uncharacteristically, Captain America has decided that the Avengers should go it alone and not be accountable to the politicians. But it's Iron Man who has decided, yes, we should be held accountable. And so the Avengers split into two warring camps. You know, Marvel knows how to do these movies in their sleep at this point, practically. You know, they all look of a piece. They all look great, expensive, great cast, great directors. They get all the right people to write the scripts. And it works. It's hugely entertaining. I personally don't feel a huge emotional connection to these characters, and I really haven't since the first Captain America, which I loved, which is kind of an unusual film in the Marvel canon. But, you know, if you're going in for, you know, biff, bang, pow, this is your film. And you know, we've got Spider-Man and Black Panther are both in this film as well.
Does that work? Does that combination work?
I think this is going to be the first time we've all seen Tom Holland as Spider-Man, and he's clearly trying to distinguish himself from the old bummer Andrew Garfield Spider-Man. He's trying to be very bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, kind of young and eager to please. I think it's a little over the top, but, you know, he was kind of a last-minute addition to this, and so when the real Spider-Man films show up, we'll see how he does.
The Man Who Knew Infinity is the other movie this weekend, a smaller movie, a very different movie.
How dare you judge me?
But it is you who does of me, don't you see?
No. Quite frankly, I don't.
Don't you know what I've given up to be here? I have nothing. Do you even see the bruises on my face? I have a wife, Mr. Hardy.
Jeremy Irons in this movie about a mathematician, Ramanujan from India, who's a brilliant mathematician.
That's
Take
right.
Take us out on that.
And he's being played by Dev Patel. Jeremy Irons is great. I wish I could say that Dev Patel was also great. He does his best. I just don't think he's the right actor to play a super intense, brilliant genius of a mathematician. It just doesn't kind of work. The slumdog millionaire kid, the best exotic Marigold Hotel kid. I don't quite buy him in the role, but it's a very handsome movie and it's a very interesting story.
River Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, John. You too.
And take us with you this weekend. Subscribe to our podcast. You know you can do that on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. If you like what you hear, you can give us a rating, won't you? Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry, and this is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, whose goal is a world without blood cancers, funding research for new treatments and targeted approaches to therapy. Learn more at lls.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.